It's 6 hours, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Some have called it the storm of the century. Hurricane Matthew's outer bands of wind and rain have already come on shore on the eastern coast of the U.S. state of Florida. Florida's Governor Rick Scott.
We are preparing for the worst, hoping for the best, and not taking any chances. Regardless if there's a direct hit or not, the impacts will be devastating. Right now, we expect to see impacts all along Florida's east coast, ranging from the Upper Keys to Nassau County. We're going to see rip currents. We're going to see beach erosion. We're going to see tornadoes and hurricane-force winds. This is a dangerous storm, and it is never too early to evacuate.
Thousands of residents along Florida's Atlantic coast have left the area, anticipating Matthew's possible impact. Before making its way to the U.S., the Category 4 storm pounded numerous Caribbean islands, leaving hundreds dead. Haiti appears to be the hardest hit, with around 300 deaths reported. A grim prediction for the embattled city of Aleppo in Syria. That's right, total destruction by the end of the year. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stephen de Mistura, said eastern Aleppo may no longer exist.
We're talking about old city in particular, and thousands of Syrian civilians, not terrorists, will be killed, and many of them wounded, and thousands of them may try to become refugees in order to escape from this.
De Mistura says there are some 275,000 civilians besieged there. Meantime, the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for a bomb blast that killed at least 20. This is VOA News. As Iraqi troops gear up to retake the city of Mosul from the Islamic State, coalition officials are saying up to 45,000 troops will be needed to remain in the city after its recapture in order to maintain security. That story now from VOA's Carla Babb.
Estimates say the massive force backed by coalition airstrikes will take on between 3,000 and 5,000 Islamic State fighters entrenched in the city. Officials say some Iraqi soldiers will need about 2 more weeks of training to prepare. These troops have already been fighting in different parts of the country. The coalition says Islamic State forces face inevitable defeat in Mosul. A coalition official says a force of 30,000 to 45,000 will remain in and around the city after the battle to keep IS forces from coming back in. Police from Nineveh province and local tribal forces will secure areas inside the city. Forces that are not local will take part in protecting Mosul, but will safeguard areas outside the city. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
New public opinion polls in the United States showing support for Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson dwindling. Latest compilation of polls by Real Clear Politics shows Johnson with only 7.1% support, far behind Democrat Hillary Clinton at 43.9% and Republican Donald Trump at 40.7%. Meantime, Open USA, an organization representing more than 6,000 Latino evangelical churches in the U.S., has endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. Clinton is staying off the campaign trail for a few days to prepare for Sunday's debate. Trump campaigned in New Hampshire on Thursday, where he participated in a town hall-style gathering of supporters. 6 U.S. soldiers and 2 other men have been indicted on charges of stealing and selling sensitive military equipment to foreign buyers, including those in China, Russia, and Ukraine. The stolen equipment includes sniper telescopes, machine gun parts, body armor, and grenade launcher sights. The heads of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank say the benefits of trade must be shared more widely on a rising tide of protectionism could hurt the global economy. IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde.
The outlook for advanced economies remains subdued, and the outlook for emerging and developing economies calls for some guarded optimism with a great diversity between the various economies.
World Bank President Jim Yong Kim says inequality is far too high, which constrains growth, he says, and sparks instability.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Friday, October 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Doctors at government hospitals in Sudan went on strike yesterday, Thursday.
Three basic demands: that they improve the environment of work, that they provide a training for the doctors, and that they provide the basic needs for patients, especially in the ER, in the emergency room.
Mariam Al-Mahdi is a pediatrician and also the first woman vice president of the main opposition National Umar Party. A newspaper publisher in Sudan says he and his staff have been punished by the government for reporting the news. A South Sudan delegation says its recent visit to the United States was successful. And Zambia's main opposition leader is free on bail after denying charges of sedition.
They were charged with two offenses, one unlawful to assembly and the other one seditious practices. They have denied the charges and granted bail of 25,000 Zambian kwacha as currency.
Charles Kakoma is a spokesman for Zambia's main opposition UPND party. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe opened a new session of parliament yesterday, Thursday, and Kenya develops a TB treatment for children. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Doctors at government hospitals in Sudan began a nationwide strike yesterday, Thursday, to press home their demands for higher wages, better medical facilities, and protection from security forces. 37 of the country's major hospitals, 17 of them in the capital Khartoum, have been affected by the strike. Sudan's Minister of Health has reportedly referred to the doctors as politicized, who only want to embarrass the government at a time when the government is engaged in a national dialogue with the opposition to determine the future of the country. But Mariam Al-Mahdi, a pediatrician and also the first woman vice president of the main opposition National Umar Party, says the doctors had no choice but to strike.
The doctors have convened 3 days ago on the 3rd of October and called the State Ministry of Health for certain demands, basically three basic demands: that they improve the environment of work, that they provide a training for the doctors, and that they provide the basic needs for patients, especially in the ER, in the emergency rooms. And they have given the State Ministry of Health 48 hours to respond positively to their demands, or they will go in a strike until their demands are met, because they have been facing the violence of the needy patients who come to the emergency seeking help for very acute cases like breathlessness, problem with breathing, bleeding, or such things. They cannot provide for them anything, because in many emergency rooms, there is no even oxygen cylinders. So today, which is the day of the deadline of the warning given by the doctors, they went in strike. They have stopped working in cold cases and in the inpatient department, but they kept on, of course, seeing needy people in the emergency room.
What are the main reasons that the doctors are protesting for? What are their concerns?
Their concerns are basically that they don't have any ability to provide the minimum proper medical assistance to patients. They have a very poor work environment. They don't have any protection. The salaries are very poor. They get something like less than $200 per month for intern doctors, and it doesn't exceed double that even for the specialized ones. And they don't get any training in a fixed way. It is very much limited to the money abilities and so on. So there is no proper training given to these doctors. Now, above that, there is no legal protection for them against the violence of people.
What do you say to people who say, well, you are the doctors, your job is to treat us, to make us well? If you don't treat us, then you are not doing your professional duty.
True. These demands have been adamantly and persistently presented by the doctors. The health sector is totally abandoned, is totally neglected. So the doctors have been insisting on not going into this step because, as you said, they don't want to leave the patients not protected by not providing them any help. But it is actually now the health sector to do anything, and the people is taking their rightful anger of not finding the proper medical help at the doctors themselves. They are hitting them. They are smashing the emergency rooms. And it has now reached the point of explosion. That's why it is about time, actually, for the doctors to be truthful to themselves, to be ethical to their patients, is to stop, because they are there in a place called the hospital with no provision to give any help or to cure any disease.
Has there been any response from the Sudanese government to the doctors' request or demands?
First of all, as I said, the state minister, who is the one who has been now the icon of confrontation with his colleagues, doctors, for the last several years, he has been in full protection from any questioning. He came in the house yesterday. He said there is no problem. There is no need for any changes. These doctors are only politicized, exploited people who want to embarrass the government in this very critical time where people are going to the national dialogue, where they are calling for conclusion of national dialogue and such things.
Mariam Al-Mahdi is a pediatrician and also the first woman vice president of the main opposition National Umma Party. She was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. The editor-in-chief of the Khartoum-based Al Jarida daily newspaper says Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Service agents have punished him and his staff for reporting the news, forcing them into economic hardship. Security agents confiscated more than 10,000 copies of the paper's Tuesday edition this week, but offered no explanation for their action. Nabil Biagio reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Service, or NISS, confiscated 10,200 copies of Al Jarida newspaper on Tuesday. The editor-in-chief of Al Jarida, Ashraf Abdulazim, says the NISS decision to confiscate copies of his paper has cost him and his staff thousands of Sudanese pounds.
The National Intelligence and Security Service means to punish newspapers and impede journalistic work by causing economic losses so that we do more on self-censorship on our editorial pieces.
Abdulazim says, despite several attempts to contact NISS personnel to understand why the papers were confiscated, authorities have refused to communicate with them. Abdulazim says NISS personnel are known for quashing articles that are critical of the government.
I have courageous writers that do investigative journalism and work about issues that concern the common people and challenge the government to do more to improve people's life.
Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says journalists should be afforded a certain degree of freedom and NISS should not seize papers to censor them.
We are going to the national dialogue end on the 10th, and then a lot of laws are going to be amended, the margin of the freedom and the press, and this is will be very big.
But Bilal asserts that certain topics will remain off limits to journalists.
I can't say people can speak about the army, about the national security, about these things. Things are going to be improved.
The seizure of Al Jarida papers comes one day after the NISS confiscated copies of a Siha newspaper. Again, security operatives offered no explanation. Journalists in Sudan say NISS doesn't like them criticizing the government, talking about state-sponsored corruption, the wars in Darfur and South Kordofan, among other sensitive topics. Journalists often are forced to employ self-censorship as a survival tactic. There have been numerous confiscations of leading Sudanese newspapers this year by security operatives. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 7th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. A spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir says the visit to the United States by a delegation led by First Vice President Taban Deng-Gai was one of the most successful visits ever taken by a South Sudanese leader since the 2013 conflict. Taban Deng-Gai attended last month's UN General Assembly on behalf of President Kiir. He and his delegation were in Washington this week. Presidential spokesman Atain Wek Atain says the delegation met with State Department officials and members of Congress, although he did not say specifically which U.S. official the delegation met with. But Attang says the treatment the delegation received indicates there is a rapprochement between South Sudan and the United States.
The visit of the first vice president and his delegation is one of the most successful visits ever taken by a South Sudanese leader since the eruption of conflict in December 15, 2013.
When you say one of the most successful visits, what message did you bring for the thousands of South Sudanese here in the United States?
Well, our first audience are American before South Sudanese, because most of South Sudanese are at home. And what we tell the South Sudanese who are actually in the diaspora, it will not be anything we say, just saying, but we will do actions that will be seen by the diaspora and, as discouraging. But for the Americans, we have engaged them. The first vice president was able to deliver a very meaningful speech at the General Assembly in New York. And later on, he went and attended Atlantic Council, that is a think tank. And also, he met a number of government officials from the State Department and the Congress. And that's the engagement that, it never happened since 2013. The general situation is that, there is a rapprochement between the Republic of South Sudan and the United States of America.
You are here at a time that there are reports of renewed fighting, particularly Ye River State. And some people say that perhaps the only way to free South Sudan of this continuing violence is for President Salva Kiir to step down. First of all, what did you hear from the Americans that you met with? What did they tell you?
Well, the Americans have no intention to let President Salva Kiir end, his tenure. The Americans wanted peace agreement to be implemented by none other than President Salva Kiir himself. For those who talk about President Salva Kiir, leaving power, they are dreaming. President Salva Kiir came to power through an election that was interrupted in 2013, but yet peace agreement renewed the tenure of President Salva Kiir until 2018, when he will be going to General Assembly. The other part of your question, you talk about fighting which has taken place in Ye River. The fighting which has taken place is between our forces and the bandits. These are not groups that belong to any, political military organization. The SPLM-IO, under the leadership of the current first vice president, is a true peace partner to the Sudan People Liberation Movement government. And so the forces of the SPLM-IO are not fighting the government. So who are fighting? These are disgruntled members of the SPLM-IO that are supporters of Dr. Riak and the bandits, who are even fighting for a cause that is not known completely, because they only kill civilians.
My understanding is that most South Sudanese in this country, the United States, reside in Nebraska. Did you visit that state, and what did the people there tell you?
We have not gone to Nebraska. We have not gone to other states apart from Washington, D.C. and New York City, where United Nations and the government of United States, reside respectively. We didn't go because the purpose of coming to United States was not to campaign and go to every household that is inhabited by South Sudanese abroad. We came here for United Nations meeting and to engage the American government, which we have done successfully.
Attang Wek Attang is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with me from New York City. The presidential candidate of Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND, and his vice presidential nominee in the August 11 elections have been granted bail. Hakainde Hichilema and Jeffrey Mwamba were arrested and charged Wednesday with sedition and unlawful assembly. Zambian police said the opposition leader and his deputy addressed an impromptu gathering of UPND supporters in Mpongwe, a rural town, without a permit, which they said was illegal. The opposition leaders denied the charges. UPDN spokesman Charles Kakoma says the charges against the two-party leaders were politically motivated and intended to embarrass them.
They were arrested yesterday, and they were charged with two offenses, one unlawful assembly and the other one seditious practices. Those are cases which are minor offenses. Even the police could have granted the police bond, but the police are so scared of the authorities, they could not give them police bond yesterday, so they slapped themselves. This morning they were supposed to appear in court, but they failed to take them to court in the morning until the later in the afternoon when the director of public prosecution they allowed to take them to court. So they have been denied the charges and given a bail, granted bail of 25,000 kwacha, Zambian kwacha as currency, and two working sureties.
When do they go back to court?
Well, it is not yet clear when they are going back to court, but they will be informed on when they are going back to court.
Well, some people are saying that indeed they called on their supporters not to respect the authority and the election of Edgar Lungu, and because of that, that could have created or that could create tension and unnecessary political and possibly security instability based on their utterances, and that is where they were charged for those offenses. What is your reaction to that?
Well, what Hakainde Hichilema and Godfrey Waramamba have been saying is that this issue of the election of the president is a matter that they are pursuing in the courts of law in Zambia. They are challenging the election of President Lungu, that he did not win the election, and therefore they do not recognize him. And from their point of view, they cannot say, now we say he was duly elected and they recognize him, and then go to court to challenge his election. That would defeat their argument and the course of justice. And they are saying, because we have taken this matter to court, we don't recognize him, and because he was not duly elected.
Now, but if I may
and
ask
also,
you...
So they are part of the unlawful assembly. They were just going to buy some things from the market to take to some of our leaders that have been arrested and taken to court from the court. And when they were buying some things at the market, some people, of course, they are public figures, they are well-known, they came to greet them. And that is what they were saying was an unlawful assembly.
But the government says that it has the constitutional mandate to protect Zambians, and therefore the calls by Hakainde Hichilema and Geoffrey Mwamba are meant to stoke tension, create political instability, and thereby create a situation whereby there will be a unity government and Hakainde Hichilema will be involved in such. Is this the case?
It appears like they are just scared of the unknown. Imagining that is what the opposition, that is what Hakainde is doing. But that is far from it. Hakainde is peacefully and he is in a civil way pursuing the matter legally in the course of law. And in the course of law, that is exactly how he is going to argue, that he was not duly elected. And therefore, there is nothing that he is doing that is illegal or promoting lawlessness in this country.
Charles Kakoma is a spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotte from the capital, Lusaka. President Robert Mugabe addressed the new session of Zimbabwe's parliament yesterday, Thursday. All eyes were on the 92-year-old leader, watching for clues to the state of his health and listening for any response he might give to the recent protests against his government. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
President Mugabe, looking visibly tired, started proceedings by joking with his officials that they had given him the correct speech this time. The president stared, talk of mental decline a year ago when he reread a speech he had delivered in parliament a month before. This year, he read out a list of laws that his government wants parliament to amend or introduce to be in line with Zimbabwe's 2013 constitution and to prop up the country's moribund economy. Mugabe ended his speech by saying,
"In conclusion, I wish to remind you, honorable members of parliament, of your sacrosanct duty to enact laws and build institutions that promote development in an environment of peace and national unity. You not only have the duty to enact laws, but to also respect and adhere to them and to our constitution in word, deed, and spirit."
Zimbabwe opposition MPs who had received death threats amid reports that they planned to protest while Mugabe spoke remained subdued throughout the 30-minute speech. Since July, the opposition has teamed up with civic organizations to hold protests against Mugabe and his 36-year rule of Zimbabwe. They accuse his government of failing to fix the economy and disregarding human rights. Authorities have used force to disperse the demonstrations or prevent protesters from gathering to march. On Thursday, Mugabe also said he wanted tighter laws to avoid what he called leakages in strategic areas of the Zimbabwean economy, such as mining and tourism. Leakage is when businesses do not declare their actual profits, depriving the country of tax revenue. The problem has plagued the government for the past decade since the discovery of diamond fields in eastern Zimbabwe and the takeover of the fields by the military. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Tuberculosis is one of the most dangerous and deadly diseases in the world. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control estimates about one-third of the world's population has the disease, and it was responsible for 1.5 million deaths in 2014. In Kenya, fighting the disease in children just became easier thanks to a new drug that hit the market this month. VOA's Kevin Enoch has this report compiled with the help of Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi.
Kenya is the first nation in the world to introduce a TB treatment specifically for children. The flavored drugs are administered free of charge, dissolve easily in water, and ensure kids get the correct dosage.
Feeding children is an uphill task. Feeding children who are sick is even a more uphill task. And so mixing the medicine with their food meant that if the food was not eaten, then the medicine was not taken. That meant that children were getting inaccurate doses.
Inaccurate dosing contributed to unnecessary deaths and drug-resistant TB.
We know that drug-resistant TB is a huge problem, and that's why organizations like TB Alliance, where we're developing new drugs and new regimens to fight drug resistance. And we want to make sure that these products get into the hands are developed for children as well as we move forward.
Kenyan health officials told VOA the government will do everything it can to make sure the drugs get to the kids who need them. But in parts of Kenya and other parts of the world, access to medical care and getting a correct diagnosis are challenges just as daunting as fighting the disease. Kevin Enoch, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Armed attackers believed to be members of Al-Shabaab have attacked a residential housing area in the Kenyan town of Mandera near the border with Somalia. Governor of Mandera County, Ali Uruba, confirmed the attack on Twitter. He said six people were killed and one other person was seriously injured. An American researcher was killed in Ethiopia after protesters began throwing rocks at the car she was riding in. Officials from the University of California, Davis, said Sharon Gray was a postdoctoral researcher with the plant biology department at the university.